Everyone's experience is unique to them. This podcast contains the personal story, experience, and opinions of the speaker, rather than that of Breast Cancer Now. Hello and welcome to the Breast Cancer Now podcast. This is a series that shares the stories of people who have had breast cancer. It's also where you'll hear the voices of our nurses, researchers, and experts who help to provide support for today and hope for the future to anyone affected by breast cancer. Hello, I'm Em, and today I'll be speaking to Fran. Fran was diagnosed with secondary breast cancer last year at the age of 25. She has had surgery, chemotherapy, and radiotherapy to help reduce and contain her cancer, and has managed to continue working as a personal trainer throughout this time. Fran, thank you for joining me.
That's all right.
Could you please tell me a little bit about when you were first diagnosed with breast cancer and what sorts of treatment you've had so far?
Yeah, so back in 2019, so January 2019, I was 24 at the time. I just adopted my cat from Battersea, and it was literally a couple of days after I adopted him. He was sat in bed with me, and he was just incessantly padding on my right breast. And I kind of thought that I've just got this really weird, perverted cat. Why will he not leave me alone? And I kept brushing him away. And then it was the next time that I brushed his paw off that I then caught what I felt was a lump, and then I felt it, and it was quite a painful lump. So I was kind of like, okay, well, I know that usually non-painful lumps are kind of the ones to worry about, but I'm not quite sure about this. So actually, I was very unsure, I'm not gonna lie, I was pretty panicked. And then the following morning I called up, made an emergency appointment to see my GP, went down and saw her, and then she confirmed that there was a lump there and that I needed to go and get it scanned. So the following week I went down to the hospital into the breast clinic for an ultrasound. But when I then turned up, she actually didn't do the ultrasound because she said that I was young and hormonal, and that at 24 years old, hormonal lumps are very common, and that I didn't need to worry about it. But what I didn't know is what they're actually supposed to say to you is to monitor it in terms of your cycle. So it hormonal lumps will get bigger and smaller in terms of your cycle. And then if it doesn't actually change in size in terms of your cycle, then you know that you need to go back. I was never told that, unfortunately. So I led my life for 18 months thinking that I was normal, that it was just hormonal. And even though it was a niggle in the back of my mind, I just kind of thought, well, I don't want to make a scene, and I need to trust the person that told me that it was okay. Like, they're the professional, I'm not. Until I was then showering one day last year in July, and then I saw that there was a dimpling of where that lump was. And again, the whole of the 18 months, the lump, even though it was still there, it was still painful. And I kind of thought, well, okay, pain, maybe that's not a symptom. Like, you know, they usually say that it's the non-painful lumps that are. However, I am living proof that that is, painful lumps can still mean something. And sure enough, I then booked in for a rapid diagnostic test, because at the time in July, it was in the pandemic, and I was told that there was a 2-week delay in terms of seeing someone, and I couldn't wait for that long. I knew that this dimple wasn't a good sign, and in my gut, I just didn't feel right. So I booked in for a rapid diagnostic, saw a consultant there. He felt it, asked me to go and sit back down. When I then sat back down, I kind of wanted to apologize to him, because I initially interpreted his tone, the seriousness behind his tone, of kind of like, oh God, I've really hacked him off. I've like come here, it's a hormonal lump, I shouldn't have come. We're in a pandemic and I've just wasted their time. And it wasn't until I sat down that he said, you really need to go next door, you're going to have an ultrasound and a biopsy taken. And I thought, okay, that's interesting. Went and had that done, went back through to see him after, and then he then said that he was going to be very honest with me, that he was very concerned of what he felt, and that the radiologist next door was also very concerned about what she'd seen on the ultrasound. 3 days later, they then confirmed that I had breast cancer, and that I had estrogen and progesterone positive and HER2 negative cancer. And at the time, they said that it was non-aggressive and that it was curable. He used the curable word. He said, it's going to be okay, it's going to be cured. In the space of then 2 weeks preceding that, I had various scans that flashed up a few different things. So that my CT scan showed a mass on my liver. So then that sent me then into having a liver MRI, which then they said that it was benign. But then the PET scan that they had done then showed something in my brain. So he questioned me whether or not I'd get any symptoms about my brain, any headaches, anything like that. I had absolutely no idea what he was talking about. I've not experienced anything whatsoever. It was completely new to me. And then they sent me through for an MRI for my brain. And then that sure enough came back to show a pretty obvious tumor that was growing outside of my skull. Within about 4 days of that, I then was getting wheeled in for brain surgery to remove that tumor. But the oncologist that I had at the time said to me that if this tumor does come back to say that it's secondary to my breast, that I'm looking at about 2 to 3 years to live, or best at 10, is what she said, quote for quote. And then, so when I then had the surgery and then they removed it, my surgeon came in and said that he was pretty sure that it wasn't going to be a benign tumor, that he's seen them many times before. So I kind of knew then, okay, this is it. Like this is going to be secondary. Mm. And it did come back. So about 7 days later, it did come back to say that it was also cancer. But at that point, I wasn't going to have anyone say to me that you've only got until you're 27 years old. I wasn't going to have someone put numbers to my life. So at that point, I then sent everything over to the Royal Marsden in Fulham. They referred me on to the professor of breast cancer there. And he's been absolutely incredible. The first meeting that I had with him, he said there was going to be no doom and gloom. He said to me that we can't make promises because we can't, but that he is still going to go at this treatment with curative intent. And that was the first time since my initial diagnosis that I actually had someone use the word curative. Until that point, it had been palliative. Mm. And I just thought, okay, I've gone from palliative to now curative. We can do this. And I found someone that is going to fight this with me as much as I want to be able to fight this. And that's what was really important. I knew that I wanted to fight it. I knew that I didn't want numbers given to me. But I needed to have the right support behind me to actually be able to do it, because I can't do it on my own. And, you know, I'm not trying to defy medicine, but I genuinely just believe that I knew my body and I knew that I wasn't going to have someone say to me that I've only got 2 years, one of which being in a pandemic. I was like, absolutely not. Absolutely not. Like, I want to go scuba diving. I want to see the world.
Not having it.
Yeah. Like, you know, we're going to fight this. And so then that's what we are. So I started my treatment with the Royal Marsden, and now we're still looking for that curative intent, even though I do have secondary, but I am also a bit of a foggy secondary person. I've just got a bit of an interesting case.
Yeah. I mean, yes, there's no other way we can describe it, really. And it's quite easy to forget while you're saying all that this has happened in what, the space of like 10 months, less than that? One piece of news is that you've got breast cancer, and then having to go through all these subsequent pieces of news and treatments. So I wonder if you wouldn't mind telling us in a bit more detail how you've come up to this point, really. What's happened between then and now?
Yeah, so July 2020 was when I first saw the dimpling of my skin that then flagged that something had changed from when I first obviously found it back in 2019. So I then had brain surgery in August. That kickstarted my treatment plan. They decided that they were able to safely remove the tumour that had spread into my skull. So we removed that through brain surgery in August. I had a craniotomy, and the only bit that was left was kind of the part that he wanted to scrape out, but we knew that we could try and tackle that with other treatments, which I've had since. So I then started chemotherapy in October, the 1st of October. So I kickstarted my birthday in style, my 26th birthday on the in chemo, and had quite an aggressive dosage of chemo. I had 4 ECs every 2 weeks apart at quite a high dose. And then I then started 12 paclitaxels and had that every week for 12 weeks. It was a little bit longer because I was neutropenic, so I had a couple treatment delays, but we finished that at the beginning of March. And then had a little bit of a break. And then in between that, there was quite a lot of conversations in terms of, do we do surgery now? Or are there other methods that we should maybe explore first? And because, it's a little bit of I'm a grey area, as they like to call me. They keep calling me a grey area. I'm not I'm not to the book. So they're just trying to figure out, you know, different options and what we can do. But I sort of like to think that because I'm a grey area, it means that I'm not just another statistic, and, you know, we can fight this in an aggressive but, you know, curative intent way, which my oncologist now speaks about. So we delayed surgery so that I could then start this new drug called abemaciclib, which I picked up today. And that's having some really groundbreaking results. It's relatively new. It's only been around for about 5 years. But they say that it's groundbreaking, like, findings. So I'm hoping that I will also experience those groundbreaking results. And instead of surgery, we just tackled the rest of my skull with radiotherapy. So I finished radiotherapy last week. I had CyberKnife, which is an awesome machine. If you have a look on my Instagram or anything, you'll see the machine. I would describe it as Wall-E from Pixar. Like, yeah. I think it's like a robot. And he was pretty cool. And I had x-rays just kind of zapping into my skull for a few days, and then that was it. It was short, it was sharp, and it was done within 3 days. So the radiotherapy side of it is done. They hope that has now eradicated any chance of the brain or the skull tumor coming back. It shrank the breast lump considerable amount, and very strangely, because they initially thought that my original hospital thought that my liver mass was benign, but actually it completely disappeared in chemo, so which suggests that it wasn't benign, it was actually another metastasis, but that's gone too.
You have reacted to it with such positivity, and you say you're now in treatment where you don't think about the numbers, and you're more focused on progress, and I can really see that coming through,
yeah,
in how you speak about your treatment, and you know, describing it as exciting. And I did actually see the video of your fun Wall-E. Well, I'm saying fun. I don't know if it was not. The Wall-E robot, which does, you know, from a scientific perspective, look very cool. I can imagine also.
Yeah, it's an incredible piece of kit.
Yeah, maybe a tiny bit terrifying, but you seem to be taking it all in your stride, I would say.
I actually found it really funny. I think I'm just weird. Like, when it started, I just started laughing because it just looked like... When I went in, I was like, oh, this guy's quite cute. And then when it started and I could just sort of see it like bopping around, I just imagined it's, yeah, essentially like a Pixar robot, and he's just sussing me out, and he was just staring at me like on this table, just kind of like bopping his head around. And then I just got the giggles, and then I found it really funny, and then I was more thinking, oh my God, stop laughing, because you've got to lie still. So yeah, I kind of just humanized it, I suppose, and didn't actually find it that scary, because I gave him a name, and I just thought, yeah, he's my friend. He's going to try and save my life, hopefully.
Yeah, that is an absolutely fantastic way of looking at things. And we're going to talk a bit more about this kind of positivity and a positive mental attitude. But first of all, I was hoping we could talk about your amazing physical achievements, because you are a personal trainer and have continued working as a personal trainer throughout your treatment, which is incredible. And I think you've written for us before in a blog post that you actually managed to get back to your normal level of activity. Well, normal for you, probably very intense for someone else. Just a couple of weeks after having brain surgery.
Yeah.
So do you mind me asking, what kind of things help drive you to keep up this physical activity?
Fitness is been a long passion of mine. I've been a personal trainer now for about 5 years. And it was something that I knew it, I didn't want it to get in the way. I had a back injury as well in May last year. So 2020 was great fun. I was actually paralyzed in May last year, 2 months before I got diagnosed with breast cancer. Oh, because I was training in my garden and I took an accident and I slipped a disc and it paralyzed my left leg. So I had emergency spinal surgery and had to regain the ability to walk, the ability to move, get the strength back in my leg again. So I was rehabbing that really hard. And then when I then got diagnosed with cancer, and I was going into brain surgery, and then I never knew that. And then they said to me that I was most likely going to be then having chemo. I knew all of these things were going to have a negative effect on my back too, and my back progress. And I'd worked so hard on trying to get that back that I just didn't want that to end. But also in the back of my mind, I was like, well, I know that exercise helps cancer. There is research to show that exercising, it, you know, it helps to prevent your chance of getting cancer. Obviously not in my case, but it does. But also it will help me with treatment and it's going to help me get through. And my oncologist was also very much behind this. So when I moved over to the Royal Marsden and I got my new oncologist, and he was very much behind me maintaining my fitness level to as much as I could do to a good degree, and not, you know, not being silly with it, but a sensible amount. I knew that I was going to do this so that I could keep strong, hopefully fight the fatigue for the rest of my treatment. When I came out of brain surgery, though, in August, so before I started chemo, actually a huge part of that was, one, I was desperate to get out of the hospital to see my family. It was terrifying, to be honest, going into having brain surgery in a pandemic because you don't get any visitors. I didn't know when I was going to see my family again. So when I was released out of ICU and back onto the ward and the physio came around, I was like, right, when can we get up? I want to get up. Like, let's just, you know, I want to move. I want to prove that I can do this because I really just want to go and see my mum and dad. And I think a lot of it was mental determination of, not, you know, I'm not going to be silly and discharge myself, but I want you to be able to tell me that I'm healthy enough to go home. And to do that, we need to get up, we need to walk, and I need to be able to prove that I can stand on 2 feet and I can walk up and down these stairs. And so we did. 2020 brought even more bad luck. Unfortunately, the day that I came out of hospital, my grandmother really suddenly passed away. And that was a complete shock to the entire of my family. Oh, thank you. Yeah, it was a shock. She passed away in her sleep. No one was seeing it coming. And obviously the funeral was then going to be coming up. And I was told that potentially I wouldn't be able to go because they live quite far up north. And at that time I was at risk of getting blood clot because of post-surgery, and also potentially just wasn't going to be strong enough to be able to do the journey and to be able to get there. But I was determined. I was like, no, I want to be there for my dad. I have to be there for my dad. And I was, and I worked on it. And every day I went out for a little bit longer for a walk. I then started doing some resistance band stuff that I did at home. Obviously I am trained, I am qualified to know my body and to know what I'm doing, but I was gradual with it. I listened to my body and I got through that. And then it meant that 2 weeks later, I was then able to go up there and I was able to attend her funeral. And I think a huge part of this has been that mental strength of, I didn't want brain surgery to get in my way of going to the funeral. I didn't want chemotherapy to stop me from getting the progress in my back. All the while, I wanted to keep up this level of strength and this level of fitness to be able to get through the treatment. I knew that it was going to be aggressive and I knew that it wasn't going to be pretty at times, but I knew that if I could keep up my activity levels, that I could potentially fight the fatigue, because they say if you can keep active, then actually the fatigue won't hit you as hard. And I definitely believe in that. When I was going through chemo, I had 6 months of it and it was not pleasant at times. However, I never actually really got fatigued. I never got the chemo fatigue that I'd read about, that I'd heard about. And I think a large part of that is because of the fact that I was able to keep up with my fitness, and I was able to keep up with the, you know, I have a stationary bike at home. I did little pedals on that. I'd go out for my walks and I kept up with my resistance training so that my muscle didn't waste through chemo. And it kept my joints healthy, which unfortunately is something that chemo can attack, but actually all the while came out of it. And now I'm working my way back up. A huge part of it is mental strength of kind of, I had barriers that I needed to overcome. And it was kind of a, you know, playing around and listening to my body. And I sort of like had to learn as I went, but I did learn it. And I did kind of learn how to respond to my body. And I learned the exercise that works, which I'm really grateful for. And it's made me completely in awe of the human body, to be honest.
Yeah. I think one of the key things that you touched upon there is kind of learning from your body, listening to your body. And if there's one thing that I can kind of take from what you've spoken about, is that there's very much a connection between yours in particular, but perhaps everyone's mental and physical health, and motivation and just attitude in general. Again, I'm very sorry to hear about all these things that have happened to you in 2020. It started with one thing and then it just seems to have been a domino effect, really. Yeah. I admire you for kind of speaking about this, because
Oh, thank you.
It must be difficult, but also I think you're kind of showing people that a positive attitude is actually, you know, it's achievable and it's helping you. I can kind of see that it's helping you in the way that you speak about it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it goes without saying that your mental health must have taken a huge hit in the last year.
Yeah.
And what steps have you taken to kind of look after that in the same way that you look after your physical health?
So I started with a psychologist. That was a big thing. So I check in with my psychologist every 2 weeks, and I have done since I started chemo. And that was an important step for me. And that really helped to learn different techniques and also just to have someone to talk to. I think it was, you know, I have a very, very good support network and I have a very close family, but I did feel that it was nice just to have someone that I could speak to and not feel like I was burdening them. I felt like sometimes I didn't want to upset my family, and as much as they would want me to talk to them about everything and they're there for me 24/7, at times I didn't want to. At times I didn't want to upset them. I didn't want to put that pressure on them. So I started out with a psychologist, and yeah, and I think that's a really important thing, that if anyone is having any kind of difficulties in terms of their mental health, that actually reaching out to the right avenues will make a huge difference. Because there was a part of me that thought, I don't need a psychologist, I'm okay, like I'm fine, I didn't feel like I was depressed as such, but then there were days where I just felt really demotivated and I would get randomly tearful, and then I kind of thought, actually no, these are signs. These are signs of depression, and these are signs that I am struggling. And so I reached out and I got the help that I needed. They also did put me on an antidepressant as well, which I am still on. So I started that in January. That's just to boost my serotonin, essentially. So they said the amount of stress that I would have gone through last year from my back to getting diagnosed, brain surgery, chemotherapy, you know, and all the while kind of also having the stress in the back of my mind and a lot of anger, I suppose, in terms of the fact that I was misdiagnosed 2 years ago, that was always going to be kind of like just niggling away. There are quite a lot of things that I've managed to kind of learn to do myself, I suppose, and try and sort of view my treatment and to view this in a more positive way and what I can get out of this instead of what this is taking away from me. But in terms of getting external help, I think that that's it's a huge step, and it's a brave step for someone to make, to say, actually, you know, hello, I really actually do need some help. But if you then look at how many people there are that are actually needing help, you will be surprised that you really, really aren't alone in that. And then there are so many people that are also in the same boat as you that are also getting help, especially with this pandemic.
And yeah, it is easy when you're speaking to kind of forget that you dealt with the same pandemic that we're all dealing with at the same time, which has obviously put a lot of barriers in place for you there.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you were still able to access help for your mental health. But with a physical diagnosis, such as breast cancer, the impacts on your mental health, even though they might not be there explicitly on the paper, you know, saying this is what we're diagnosing you with, these are the impacts of this, inevitably a lot of people do have these side effects of feeling depressed, of feeling anxious. Is there anything that you might do on the day-to-day, or just you know, a way of thinking that would help you get through a particularly difficult day?
Yeah, so I adopted a kind of mindset right from when I was diagnosed of, I'm just going to take it literally every step by step. And then that's what I've maintained the whole time. And I literally mean down to what is the smallest step that I can think of that I need to get through in this next phase. So when I was diagnosed, I was like, okay, I've got cancer. So what's the next step? And I knew that the next step was going and getting a CT scan. And that's all I then thought of. I didn't think of what are the results going to be like for the CT scan or what comes after the CT scan. And it's hard at first to try and kind of adopt that, because your mind does want to run away with you and it does want to sort of think, you know, well, what if, and what if this happens, and, you know, what if it has spread? But you don't know the answers to that until you get the results. So there's no point actually thinking that or trying to second guess it. And then, you know, so I had that, and then obviously then they flashed up with the thing with my brain and then the brain MRI. So then it was like, okay, well, what's my next step? Surgery. And that's all I then thought of. I didn't think, how's surgery going to go? What am I going to be like after surgery? There's so many things that I could have thought of. And I knew, obviously, they tell you essentially how it's going to be after surgery and what you're going to have to come up against. But I didn't think about that. I just thought, all I know is that I need to put the gown on. I need to pull up those really sexy compression socks. And then I'm just going to go and I'm just going to have surgery. Mm. And I'll get through the rest when I get to it. And I've just done that through the whole thing. You know, I could sit there and I could think, okay, well, I've got metastatic cancer at the age of 26. So what does that mean then when I'm in a year's time or 2 years' time? So there are so many things that you could sit there and think, but you just don't know the answers to them. So instead of thinking about them, I just think, well, what's the next step? So now I know that my next step is tomorrow morning. I will then just wake up and take my new tablet, take my new drug, and then that's going to be that. And then we just roll with it. And then every step is just every step. Mm. So that was a huge turning point for me when I then started adopting that mindset and thinking, okay, I'm just going to literally break it down into small steps. And I do it on a daily basis. So, okay, so what's my next step? All right, I'm going to coach a couple classes, see some clients. That's my next step. And then have breakfast. That's my next step. If I've got something that's coming up, like for example, today I was in the hospital this morning, but I didn't think about like, oh, okay, so like in 3 hours' time, I'm going to be at the hospital. I'm going to have blood tests. I'm going to be like, you know, doing all of these things. I just thought, okay, now I'm going to go to the hospital, walk up the steps. That's my next step. Then my next step is just sit going into the waiting room and, you know, taking a free biscuit from the tray, because why not? And just those kind of things. And then instead of thinking about it as like the huge picture, just breaking it down into very, very small little bit, like little chunks that you can just actually get your brain through.
I love that. Just, yeah, whatever you're going through, just the next step is the most important step, I guess, in a way. If you can get through that, you can get through the next bit.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. I was going to ask, how has your life changed since diagnosis? And it just sounds so full on what you've said, but also I know that you've actually kind of, I don't know, you've not changed your career path per se, but you're focusing on more oncological fields. Is that right?
Yeah, my focus in terms of my career has massively changed this last year. Taking myself through treatment and seeing the benefit that exercise had with me, I really massively wanted to then go into something that I was going to help other people that are going through the same things. So I'm starting on the qualification that means that I will become an exercise and cancer specialist. And I should hopefully qualify with that in July. And then that means that now going forward, my client base is going to very much be tailored towards helping people that are going through treatment. And I'm going to take that both online and also in person. So I'm hoping to do some work actually within hospitals as well, alongside the physios. And then also having an online business that means that I can actually coach people anywhere in the country or hopefully internationally as well. And the kind of the good thing that came out of the pandemic in terms of the fitness industry, as difficult as it was at times, obviously when the gym shuts, but we had to revamp it, we had to reinvent. So, and we've shown that actually training people online and doing Zoom, you know, one-to-one PT sessions actually works. And being in gyms was actually kind of sometimes a little bit of an intimidating atmosphere to be in when you were going through chemo or anything like that. And obviously your immune system is compromised, being around too many people and potentially being in kind of like a gym-based environment may not have been the one. So actually being able to do it from the comfort of your own home is a lot more accessible to people. Mm. So that's what I'm hoping to achieve by the end of this year, is to get all of my platform on and take people online program if they want to do that, whether they want to do that in the gym. So I've got an app that they'll then be able to like take that in with them and then be able to do the program that I have set them, or one-to-one based PT sessions, but virtually. So then they can do it and I can do that anywhere. And then, yeah, I've spoken out like a lot. Obviously, I've been very open in terms of my story and stuff. I really want to create awareness in terms of my story and the fact that, you know, I unfortunately was kind of fobbed off when I was 24 and told that I was hormonal and that I had a hormonal lump and I wasn't given the scan that I was supposed to. And being very open about that and speaking out about that is actually quite scary, how many women and men have also experienced the same thing. And I really want to push for the fact that cancer doesn't discriminate against age, lifestyle, anything. You know, I was 24, PT. I trained 6 days a week. I was doing Ironman, CrossFit. I was vegetarian, didn't smoke. You know, I was completely gene tested and I've got none of them. Mm. And so I'm kind of living proof that it unfortunately can happen to any of us. So I've been very open about that. So then I've then now started doing work with like other people. So obviously like Breast Cancer Now, I've kind of like been open with you guys about my story, and Copperfield, started doing some stuff with them. I'm actually in the sideline trying to write a book.
Wow.
So I'm trying to work through that as well. Yeah. And then I then am now an ambassador for the Battle Cancer Program, which is a free fitness program for people that are going that are post-treatment. So if you've had cancer treatment and you are looking to rehab yourself back into everyday living, the Battle Cancer Program is free access for people to be able to start getting their training routine back in. So it's an online thing that they can then have their program at home. They can decide whether they do that at home or in the gym. It can be equipment based, non-equipment based. It's a relatively new thing that Scott Britz and his partner, they have set up, and it's an amazing organization. And Battle Cancer itself, which is the organization that they started, does a lot of fundraising for cancer. So they hold different fitness events across the world, which is accessible for anyone. So when I say it's a fitness event, it's not intimidating in that like you have to be an elite, you know, fitness goer to compete in these things. It's literally accessible to anyone. So you can turn up with one arm and then the judge will just give you a different exercise to do. And they've made it so that, you know, anyone can do it, but all with the same idea that you are going there to raise money for cancer. And then on the back of that, they then created this Battle Cancer Program, which is free access to everyone. And now they've been registered as a charity, which is even more amazing. So they've been given that approval to be a charity. So it's something that I get asked a lot on I have a lot of people reach out to me on my Instagram and through my blog, asking me for advice, or people saying to me that they want to get back into fitness, but they just don't know how to do it, or they're so scared to do it and they don't want to hurt themselves, or it's been so long that they have gone without it that they're just not sure what they're doing anymore. Mm. And the Battle Cancer Program has massively helped with that, because it's starting to get people back into their fitness and showing them what they can do. And I'm really honored to be made an ambassador for that, so that I can keep pushing it as well to help as many people as we possibly can.
And everything that you've just spoken about there, all this that you're giving to other people, what sorts of things can people do to help you, or to help secondary breast cancer patients in general? What kind of things have you found helpful in your life that people have done for you?
I think a massive thing that really helped me when I was going through treatment, literally as simple as it sounds, is just being there. It sounds really basic and it sounds really simple, but it's actually something that people, I think, struggle with when they hear the word cancer. It's still quite taboo and it's a frightening word and people want to run away from it. And I do often think, you know, if the roles are reversed and I had a friend that was diagnosed with cancer, how would I react? Would I, you know what to say? And maybe I wouldn't. But when you are going through cancer, it can be incredibly difficult when those avenues of contact between your friends stop. And I experienced that, and I was very open about that on my social media. And I was really shocked actually at how many people came back to say that they had experienced the same, where you feel like you've actually lost friends because you were diagnosed. And I don't think it's anything against those people in particular. I don't think they're bad people, but I think it's just a case of people find cancer awkward and they just don't know what to say. And I think because they can't take it away from you, they don't actually know what they can do for you. So in kind of a self-preservation mode, they just distance themselves. But actually it's incredibly hurtful and it's incredibly painful to feel like you've got this disease and then that's stopped your friendships and that stopped your support network. I was very thankful that, you know, I did experience that, but I also experienced the other side, and I have very good supportive friends, and I've kind of built a great community through the realms of social media by being open about it. And I've met virtually so many people that have been amazing. But I think if you know someone that has been diagnosed with it, the number one thing that you can do, even if you don't know what to say, you don't actually have to say anything about, you know, necessarily specific on that, but just literally saying to them, anything that I can do for you, just let me know. And then and then it's in their court. Like, if they want to reach out to you, they can reach out to you. But they may just want to take a walk and not talk about it. They might not want to talk about the cancer side of stuff. They just might want to talk to you about what's going on in your life, or, you know, the fact that the weather's nice, or just something that can distract them. Because I know, for one, every day of my life is filled with, like, is a reminder that I have cancer. From, you know, in the morning I have to take my medications, boom, reminder that I've got cancer. So sometimes you just want to sit down with your mate and have a chat and not kind of go over it, and just talk about the things that you would do. You know, I'm still the same person that I was before I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And, you know, your friend is still that same person before that they got cancer. And it hasn't changed them, and it hasn't changed the topics of conversations that you can speak about, or the laughs, you know, the sense of humor that they had before. They're still going to laugh at, like, the same things. They're still going to enjoy the same things. They may have forgotten what they enjoy, because it can be, you know, very consuming. And so you might just need to remind them about the things that you used to do and enjoy, like take them out for a day out, send them a little gift in the post. I love those things. Like, just something literally as small as just sending a little card, just to say that they're thinking of you. Those things make such a huge difference, because you then, you know, like, it's kind of one of those things where you could ask someone and then they could say to you, oh yeah, but I think about you all the time. But you don't know that those people are thinking about you unless you actually show it. So just something as small as, you know, a little card in the post, or if they're going through treatment, you know, if they're going through chemo or something like that, maybe just send them some fluffy socks if they're cold capping to keep them warm, or, you know, something like that, that they can just feel that, oh, they've actually really thought about me and they're supporting me. Little simple gestures like that. And I, for one, was very much sort of a bit of a lone wolf, and, you know, I had a lot of friends asking me if they wanted me to pick me up stuff and do things for me, and I was like, oh no, it's fine. But then you get surprised, actually people really want to do that. Like, I kind of felt bad, but people actually really want to do it, because, as I say, like, they can't take cancer away from you, so they're kind of screaming at you like, no, I can't help you with that, but I can do this, like, please let me do this. So also, on the other foot, if you do have cancer or you're going through something like this, and you've got people reaching out to you, and you've got your friends reaching out to you saying, you know, can I do this for you, and you feel sort of obliged to say no and kind of do it yourself, actually it helps them if you actually say yes, because it makes them feel like they're actually doing something, they're not helpless anymore.
Yeah,
so it kind of works in both ways. We have to sort of accept that we need to let them help, because they need to feel like they can help, and that's the way that they can do it. But then also, you need to, if you are the friend, make yourself accessible and kind of not be pushy, but make yourself visible and say, hey, you know, I'm here.
Yeah.
Like, if you need me, I'm here.
Yeah, thank you again for that. I feel like I keep saying thank you after all your answers, because they are genuinely just, like, excellent and very helpful.
Oh.
But also, even when I've asked you, like, oh, you've done a lot to help other people, how can people help you? You're still speaking about helping other people, which I think is just a testament to your your good nature and everything that you're working on at the moment. To keep up with Fran and her impressive fitness feats and her story, you can follow her on Instagram at Fran Whitfield. And thank you so much for joining me today, Fran.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you for listening to the Breast Cancer Now podcast. Make sure to subscribe to our channel on your preferred podcast service to hear our next episode. If you have any questions or concerns from listening today, you can find information on our research, services and campaigning on our website at breastcancernow.org.